Hey, ¿qué pasa, Calexico? Welcome back to the podcast. Like always, before we begin, I want to thank a couple of people. I want to thank my anchor sponsors, Camilo, Sergio, Jake, and Dylan. Thank you guys for sponsoring the podcast. I also want to thank my friends at Dents on Border. If you have a dent on your car, make sure to follow them on Facebook. Also want to thank my friends at Sergio's Tacos and Hot Dogs, serving the Imperial Valley for over 8 years with Mexicali-style hot dogs and taquizas. You know, they also serve Yuma and San Diego counties. So if you're looking for a taquero, make sure to contact Sergio at 760-562-0057. Also want to thank David Gastelum. If you're thinking of buying or selling a home in the Imperial or San Diego counties, make sure you contact David. He's not only a realtor, but an investor with over 20 years of experience in the Imperial San Diego counties. His phone number is 760-235-9576. And lastly, like I've been doing in these last episodes, trying to promote our local businesses, I want to thank my friends at Calexico Brewing Company. They've been a huge part of the podcast success. You know, early on, I was able to record a lot of my episodes there. So I want to shout out Calexico Brewing Company. Make sure to follow them. Their website, I'll leave a link in the description. They are open. They're selling their beer to go. So make sure to follow them on social media and to check out their website. My guest today is somebody that I first caught eye on. I think it was Mi Calexico had a little profile on her. And then recently, the Calexico Chronicle also made a little article about her. And I was telling her that it might sound kind of corny, but that night before I was thinking of people to interview because I'm kind of tired of election and politicians. I just wanted to talk to somebody, you know, that's not politically or political. It's been so crazy these last couple of weeks with the election, especially here in the Valley. But yeah, I was thinking about her, and then the next day I saw the article. I was like, man, I hope they don't think I'm copying, you know, getting interviews from their newspaper. But I guess great minds think alike. So my guest today is Darlene Barbayanis Boggs, who is from Calexico, and now she is in New York, and she is an ACLU paralegal. Thank you for being here today. I think you're muted. There you go.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, getting used to the whole unmute thing even after so many months.
I know, it's crazy. Can you tell us a little bit, you know, normally when I have a guest, I have them tell us a little bit about themselves. So can you tell us a little bit about you and, you know, growing up here in Calexico in the Valley and, you know, a little bit before you got to where you're at now?
Yeah. So, you know, I was born in El Centro and I was raised all my life in Calexico I went there for elementary through high school. I grew up in Paulina Avenue, you know, going to Rockwood, just from kindergarten to sixth grade. But every weekend I would spend in Mexicali with my family and, you know, come back mostly just to be in Calexico for school. I actually hated being in Calexico growing up. Also didn't know English when I was little, so I just really hated going to school. And then, you know, like as I grew older and learned English, I started feeling more comfortable in Calexico. And I would still go to Mexicali a lot, but it wasn't as often. And I grew up, you know, mostly with a single mother who got married until I was like 15 in high school. Growing up in Calexico was, I feel very lucky that, you know, I got that transnational experience. Like I never felt like, I always crossed back and forth from like Calexico and Mexicali. So I feel very close to both of them as my home. But you know, in the US it was only like me and my mom that lived here from my immediate family. And then, so it was mostly like all my family still lives in Mexicali and are not able to cross. So I feel like my like familial connections are mostly in Mexicali. And like growing up in Calexico, like I just felt like, you know, it was a very special experience because you get to see like two different worlds collide and just kind of create a new world. And when I was in high school, I remember my mom was like helping migrant farm workers with their taxes. And I think that's when I got like a real close on exposure on like you know, migrant farm workers, but also like the daily commute and the injustices like they suffer in at the fields. Because I feel like before that it was just, it was so normalized, like everything was so normalized, like, you know, like working long hours, like crossing the border, getting sent to secondary inspection, like the border being so militarized. And I just felt like that to me didn't faze me. It was just, it felt very normal. Like that's the way it should be. And I think like at the end of high school, that's kind of when I started realizing that, you know, like that was not normal and it was not okay. And then I went to Imperial Valley College for 2 years. And I met a lot of great people there and a lot of great professors, but also I remember telling my counselor, like, you know, like I want to transfer to Berkeley, and my counselor being like, I don't think you should aim for that. Like, that's too high. You should try something else. Like, I don't think you'll get in. And I think that sticks with me a lot because I just feel like I feel like I didn't take that in too hard. Like, I was just like, no, well, I just won't listen to you and I'll do my own research. But I constantly think of like other people that have been affected by counselors' words, or a lot of like in Calexico High School, like I just didn't feel like very encouraged in school, or like I didn't feel like I was like learning as much as I could from a lot of teachers. I mean, although there is a lot of great teachers there, so I don't want to like, you know, but I guess I just thought like Calexico like really shaped me to be who I am, and it taught me to be very resourceful and just like, you know, like taught me a lot of grit. And I've learned so much from the people there that I don't think I could be where I am now if it wasn't for all like the experiences and all the great people I've met there.
You talk about, you know, how you didn't see, and that was one of my questions that I had, you know, planned to ask you, about, you know, being living here in the border. We kind of get desensitized in the sense of, you know, in terms of like immigration. You know, we see it all the time. You know, we see people coming back and forth illegally. Some of them like do it like probably before 9/11, it was like super easy to come back and forth. You know, we probably had people in our family that were doing this, or friends. I remember going to Second Street and playing basketball, and like kids would jump the border and like come play basketball with us. And you know, we kind of like grow like a little bit desensitized in terms of, you know, why so many people want to come to this country. What are some of the reasons what they're running away from? You know, being now that you've, you know. And I kind of wanted to talk about this later on during the interview, because I think there's so much more that we could talk before you went to the ACLU. But do you feel that, you know, that does affect us? The fact that, you know, we've seen it a lot growing up, you know, people coming back and forth, you know, I mean, a lot of the people that are in the news here locally are because they were either crossing people illegally or crossing drugs. So do you feel that we get desensitized in the sense of the real need as to why a lot of people come to this country?
You know, that's a great question. And I don't want to speak for others' experiences, but I think in my own experience, I think like growing up in Calexico, I did feel like I was very desensitized. I have a list too, so S's are kind of hard. Desensitized because it was just the norm, you know? It was just normal to see people lining up to be deported. And it is the norm for to have family members who, or like friends who cross and come back. And I think another thing that I've been thinking about lately is just that I know there's like a lot of undocumented folk in Calexico, but it's something that it's not talked about comfortably because it's such a militarized like town. And like, you know, heavily patrolled by like border patrols and customs. So I think a lot of people are not even like, come in contact or are conscious that they're coming in contact with undocumented people or people whose status like is sensitive, because, you know, we don't talk about it, or they don't feel comfortable living in Calexico because it's so close to the border. So I think a lot of people you know, like have this idea that like, well, people should be crossing here the right way because almost everyone we know or think everyone we know is documented or comes here with a visa or with a tourist visa. So I feel like it creates kind of this false narrative of like people like being able to easily access and cross the border when in reality, you know, it's very hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, it's maybe like my upbringing like desensitized me, but I don't know. Like I wouldn't be able to speak for others' experience.
After IVC, where did you go to school?
So after IVC, I just wanted to move out. So I moved to Berkeley, but I attended Berkeley City College, so the community college in Berkeley, with a plan that I wanted to eventually transfer to UC Berkeley. So after a year there, I was accepted to UC Berkeley and I ended up doing my undergrad at Berkeley.
I was reading on your bio on the ACLU, and something that caught my eye was you worked with Professor Marianne Constable on the research pertaining to exonerated women who killed their husbands in the early 20th century in Chicago to explore the rhetoric of law and history. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It's kind of like something that caught my eye. I don't know why.
Yeah, no, I mean, I like the limited research I did for her. It was very interesting too. I actually did not know much about it. So basically, it actually is kind of like the movie Chicago is based on this. Basically, in like the early 20th century, like, you know, after World War One, a lot of men were depressed because there was a lot of unemployment, or a lot were traumatized from the war, a lot were drafted, and there was a rise in alcohol consumption. And there was a lot of domestic violence, like correlating with the high, like the rise of like alcohol consumption. And some women ended up killing their husbands, but ended up later getting acquitted. And I thought that was very interesting because, you know, I think the legal system is very broken, and especially the court system. And I think it was like that research was very interesting because it was like one of the first times in early history that you can see the court having like a more feminist, like, you know, perception. But like at the same time, I do want to like point out that these were a lot of white women that were getting exonerated. So I don't know if that would have been true, like for other women of color or black women or indigenous women. So, but at the time when I was doing that research, I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah, I was a little bit, kind of like, yeah, like questioning, like, what was some of the things that you, you know, found out about, you know, that era? And like you said, obviously it shows you also that, you know, yeah, it was women, but it was also a lot of white men, women. And I mean, I don't want to get into that, but, yeah. So from there, you graduated, and then how did you start it? Because I heard, I think it was in the Calexico Chronicle article, was that the reason that you kind of went the way you went was because of an anthropology class that you took?
Yeah, so I mean, anthropology, I really loved anthropology. I actually wanted to be a journalist growing up so bad. Like, I watched The Ring, like that scary movie, and I got obsessed with The Ring, and I'm like, wow, being a journalist looks so fun, so I want to be a journalist, you know? And I remember taking like classes at like Imperial College in journalism, but I was like, I don't know if this seems like something I want to do long term. I like it, but I don't feel passionate about it. And then I was going to study like rhetoric and sociology at Berkeley, and then I remember meeting a friend's brother who was from Calexico, and he was doing his PhD in anthropology at Northwestern. And I was telling him about my interests and how I was very interested in culture, especially like border culture. And he suggested, like, maybe you should study anthropology. Like, I think that's more in line with what you want to do. So when I went to Berkeley, I was just like, fuck it. I'm just going to, like, I mean, like, no worries, you know, no sorry. Like, I was just like, I'm just going to study anthropology. It seems like more aligned with my interests. And I ended up really loving it. I also did rhetoric, which was a little more intense. It's very writing heavy. It's like very argumentative. And I think the combination of both was really great for my career, because I decided that I wanted to go to law school, because I was thinking of first doing a PhD and maybe anthropology, but I I personally felt like a PhD wouldn't give me tangible results. Like if I wanted to make a difference, I felt like the PhD route, it would take a long time for me to see any sort of like difference that I made. And I felt like the law was like a way that I can use my skills, writing skills, people skills. I love talking to people and I'm very social. So I thought that would be a good way to combine a lot of my interests and also a very tangible way of making change. So I did an internship in undergrad at Bankston Immigration Law Firm. And most of the cases there that I worked on were LGBT asylum cases. And I think that just like really like opened my interest in immigration law, because I guess it was very different than the type of immigration law that I saw back home, which was mostly family based, you know, like, oh, you're bringing your primo, you're like your abuelo. So it's just kind of, it felt very like different, and it opened my eyes more to like specifically like problems in like a lot of Central Americans face that we don't talk about in the Valley. I mean, I know it's now more of a topic, especially with a lot of Central Americans coming to the border. But back then, I did not know much about it. So that's like kind of what opened my interest to immigration law.
Yeah, and it's so crazy how one thing can take you from trying to do something to another thing. And even once you thought, yeah, like immigration law, and then you go to LGBTQ, you know, cases, and it's like you open another Pandora's box with all kinds of different cases and stories. And that's something that a lot of, like I said earlier, like we get desensitized in terms of what brings people to this country and you know, LGBTQ reasons, you know, stories can be another big part of why a lot of people decide to come to our country. Even though I feel there's more countries, other countries that are a little bit more open in terms of accepting, you know, LGBTQ people. But I guess maybe it's the closest and the easiest to get to. How did you end up in New York and working with the ACLU?
Yeah, so after college, I worked like in business immigration, and then I worked in removal defense for this pretty well-known firm, like nationally, that handles like complicated removal defense cases, specifically with people with criminal backgrounds. And I, you know, that was an extremely great experience. It really changed like my like perception on like criminal law, but also like, it also like gave me an idea of what I want to do in the future. But that being said, it was very emotionally taxing. It was very heavy. And so I decided to take a break, like from working, and just focus on my law school applications and taking my LSAT. And I'm like, I was like, I want to move to New York because I've always wanted to live in New York. It's been a dream of mine. I wanted to take kind of a break from the law, and I just wanted to do something different because I felt that it was now or never that I was going to do it. And I remember before moving to New York, I saw that the ACLU had a posting, and it was an organization that I admire for many reasons, especially the Immigrants' Rights Project, because it was something totally different that I've done. It's impact litigation, which is, you know, like not doesn't involve direct client services. It's a lot of large cases, a lot of class actions. And I applied. I was like, I don't know if I'll get it because it's very competitive, but I'll do it. And in my cover letter, I actually spoke a lot about like my experience growing up in the border. And I moved to New York, and like a few hours after landing, I had my second interview. So I had not really slept. I had, my hair was kind of all like messed up, but I think it went really well. I guess I did. And then even in my after email, I was like, oh, like, I'm sorry, I was so sleep deprived, but I hope like it went really well. I still feel really comfortable even on 3 hours of sleep. And then after that, it took a long time for me to hear back because just like such a large organization, it was so slow. But yeah, I ended up starting in January, and I think I interviewed in September. So it was a while before, and I just like lived in New York.
So it was January of 2020?
Yeah.
So yeah, okay. So it's like right before shit hit the fan, right?
Yeah.
So how's it been? I know we were talking before we started recording, but how has it been being in New York during this pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting in the beginning. Just like, I guess in the beginning, I just didn't feel like it was real, or just it felt so momentarily. You know, I thought I was like, okay, we're gonna be in quarantine for like 3 weeks, and I remember just like my boss coming into my like cube and just being like, grab your stuff because I think we're going under quarantine tomorrow. It was just like one day to the other. And we're like, okay. Like I remember grabbing myself and trying to take everything I can and like, you know, like just never going back to the office again. I mean, so it's been so long and we're probably not going to go back in a long time. And I remember everyone in New York being extremely, like, there was a lot of paranoia the first few days, but also just, like, a lot of uncertainty and a lot of people saying masks didn't work and a lot of people just, like, not, I don't know, there was so much, like, misinformation and I was very worried. I was like, oh, my God, if they shut airports down, I want to be close to my family. I don't want to be so far away. So we decided to go back to Southern California for a bit, and we stayed there for a couple of months, and then we came back to New York. But right now, New York, actually, it's really loud outside, so sorry for the background noise. But right now, New York, it was doing really great with its numbers, and things felt like a lot. I mean, there was more people outside, and but I think, you know, that's going to change probably with the second wave coming by, and well, like the weather changing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously the weather brings more people inside because it's, I mean, especially in that area where it gets colder than it is here. Even here when it gets like, I don't know, 50, like people are dying from, you know, the cold and, you know, they want to go inside. You talk about misinformation and you know, doing some research on the ACLU. It's crazy how a lot of people portray the ACLU as being as a, you know, leftist organization, because right now that we've been dealing a lot with immigration cases because of maybe the current administration. But I mean, it's not at all, you know, 1977, they represented the National Socialist Party of America, and because they wanted to wear swastikas. So one of their, you know, rallies, you know, when people talk to you about the ACLU, you know, what is the feeling you get about the organization?
You know, that's a very good question. I'm glad you asked. And I just wanted to say beforehand, like, everything I'm saying are my own views, and my own views don't represent the ACLU. But yeah, I think, you know, when I think of the ACLU, I recognize all the great work they have done, and I do think they're in the forefront of making a lot of change, and I admire that. However, I do think there has been a lot of problems and a lot of, in terms of like some cases they have decided to take, especially the one you just mentioned, also Charlottesville, Virginia, which was another case that they defended, you know, like white nationalists. So I don't know. I just think I always try to remind people when I think about the ACLU, it's like it's the American Civil Liberties Union, not American Civil Rights Union. And I think that's something we need to keep into consideration when thinking of the ACLU. And I think it's really fair that we criticize the work the ACLU is doing, because I don't think any organization or politician should be held in a pedestal. I think everyone needs to be criticized to keep improving their work.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, you know, obviously right now we're facing a lot of immigration cases. And it's funny because, you know, the Obama administration deported a lot of people. But I guess the biggest difference between that administration and this one is, you know, the way they've decided on taking, you know, action on immigration, especially with the, you know, the children being separated from the parents. You know, what are some of the things that you've dealt or, you know, work with in terms of these cases or heard of or.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I've like been working on a family separation, and I think, you know, it's like, it's hard for me to speak sometimes about it just because I feel like there's so many moving pieces still going on. But I think this administration, I definitely think Obama did a lot of harm in the immigration sector. But I do think the way this administration has handled a lot of immigration policies, it has worsened this, like, the immigration system and expedited and created new procedures that just has been making it way harder for many people to come or stay in this country. But I don't know if there's any specific question you had about, like, family separation or about Obama.
No, just in general, you know, can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my headphones. What's like the general perspective in terms of, you know, you being in New York? I guess most of these cases are dealt over there than they are here because of, I don't know where the ACLU's main office is. Is it in New York?
Yeah.
So, you know, what is some of the, I don't know, like the majority of the cases that you guys have of dealt with in terms of the children, are you guys dealing with those, what is it, 500 kids that are like misplaced? Are you guys?
Yeah. That's one of like, my boss is actually like one of the attorneys in that case. And I am the paralegal in that case actually. Mm-hmm. So we've been dealing with that, and it's actually, I mean, it's an ongoing process, and I don't want to speak too much about it yet, but it is something that we've been dealing with and that a lot of organizations are actually helping with. It's a travesty because a lot of these kids are like, were very young. Some were like, probably don't even remember who their parents, because they were babies, or they have spent a lot of time without their parents. And I just, yeah, I mean, it's horrible, and hopefully, like, it gets resolved soon, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. But, yeah, it's been really sad. And I feel like, especially, like, I think this is, like, an issue that hits a lot of people really closely, because a lot of people can relate, especially even people who are not, you know, usually interested in immigration matters. I think when it revolves around children and families, people are more sensitive. And I feel like that's why it also has, like, I personally feel that that's why also it has like been very evident and all over the media.
Hey guys, sorry for the interruption, but it's time to pay some bills. So here's a word from one of our sponsors. All right, so now back to our regularly scheduled podcast. Do you
have like an idea of, you know, what's the time span these kids have been away from their parents? Like, does it vary, or is it mostly the same between all of them?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, it's been like, I think it's been like a little 2 years or so. I'm not 100% sure on the number. I might come back to you on that. But yeah, it's been more than a year for sure.
Wow, it's crazy. And I like you mentioned, you know, some of them are babies that might be a year and a half old now, and they haven't been with their parents, so they.
Yeah, I think it's been like over 2 years, but I think it might be different for certain folks. So, I mean, I guess a really good case that I recommend reading, a case is called Miss L versus ICE, and it talks about more. This is one of the cases that is working on reunification.
Wow, that's crazy. Kind of changing, you know, topics a little bit more. less depressing. You're a big I guess fashionista. You like, you know, dressing up. That was something that was brought up and on your article in the Calexico Chronicle. But I also, you know, when I was, like I told you earlier, like I kind of like do research and I look on people's Instagram, and something that I did notice said that, you know, you like to dress up, and is it something that you've liked doing since you were young, or like did being in New York kind of like rub off on the way you dress?
Yeah, No, that's a good question. I think, you know, when like I was growing up, I didn't have like the money to like buy a lot of clothing, so I just feel like it wasn't like I grew up like loving dressing up. I actually really hated shopping with my mom like the few times we grew up, and we so I actually did not grow up loving it. I remember in high school I kind of got into it, but like I just feel like it wasn't a big part of my identity back then. I think when I moved to San Francisco, especially when I moved to Berkeley and started getting really into like secondhand clothing and like vintage shopping, that's when I feel like my interest really developed. And like as I got older and, you know, had more means to buy more clothes, I just felt like this was like a way I could express myself. Especially, I didn't grow up like I really wanted artistic talent so bad, but I never took classes growing up or anything, so I have like no artistic talent other than like clothing and some like and like cooking, I guess, somehow. But yeah, I started really getting into it during college, and when a lot of people, I used to live in like the Berkeley student co-ops, which were like more like oh, did I freeze?
Yeah. No, but I guess you hear you, but yeah, your video's frozen. But I can still hear you though.
Hello?
There you go.
Okay. Sorry, I think you froze. Yeah, and I think in Berkeley I just got really into it with all the secondhand clothes, and I just felt like people were more open, so I wouldn't feel as embarrassed like wearing something very out there.
Yeah, because like I said, it was on the article, but before even reading the article, I kind of like noticed that, you know, that was a big part of who you are. Also, they also mentioned your music taste, and how it, you know, it's also a big part of who you are. What is something that you listen on the daily that?
Yeah, it's so funny you said that. I mean, I guess I don't know if I'm like consider myself a musician or a big music lover. I like certainly like music a lot. But I actually listen to everything. I love like hip hop and rap and R&B. I love punk music. I love emo music. I love a lot of indie and indietronica. So I'm pretty much all over the place. I love reggaeton. You know, I just kind of feel like I feel like there's good music in every genre of music. Like I just don't really dislike any music. But yeah, I'm not a like what can I say? Like I'm not like a musician aficionado, but I enjoy music.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, because I asked because you know, it was on the article as well. Yeah, like to me, like music is something that I listen sporadically nowadays. I'm always listening to a podcast, but there's mornings when I kind of like need a little pickup, and instead of listening to, I don't know if do you ever listen to The Daily? It's a podcast from the New York Times. So sometimes like I'll watch the topic of the day for the day, and I'm like, you know what, I'm not feeling this topic today, I'm gonna listen to something. And yeah, I always go to like Biggie, like Juicy's like one of the songs that I listen in the morning for by Biggie, Notorious B.I.G. or I don't know, like probably Queen. Can't Stop Me Now is probably one of those songs that picks me up in the morning. So like listening to you, like from, you know, growing up here in Calexico to where you are now, you know, it kind of like s seems like it was something that you really didn't plan out. It was just like something that kind of happened in spur of the moment. But at the same time, I feel like because it's something, a talk that I have with a couple of friends of mine that kind of you know, went out of the valley and kind of made a life for themselves out of the valley. Whenever I tell them that, you know, yeah, it's hard for people from the valley, or hard for people like Hispanic or minority people, they always argue like, no, you know, look at me, I made it. Da, da. But I'm like, yeah, like, you know, at the end of the day, it's still hard for somebody like us to get out of the valley and, you know, make it. You know, what are your thoughts? Do you feel that, is it you, do we make it hard, or is it hard, you know?
No, that's a good question. I really hate when people say that personally, that people say like it's not hard because I made it. I think it simplifies a lot of people's like struggles, and you know, I can like I feel like I understand, like, maybe they're very proud of their accomplishments, but I don't think it is easy. And I think if like a lot of people who leave or a lot of people who make it, if you, like a lot of them, if you look back, there's a lot of privilege there that is not mentioned. And I do think, like, it is very hard. And I think there's so many obstacles in the way for a lot of, like, Latinx people or like Latinos, Hispanic, to like succeed and also making it out of the valley. I mean, but also like being in the valley, like it's like, I don't think you make it if you leave the valley. Does that make sense? Like, I think like staying in the valley, like it's such a great thing. And it's something that I always think, like, I want to come back there and do work in the valley. And it's something that's part of me. I don't feel like I left. I just feel like I'm in both. Sometimes, like, I feel part of both places at once. But I don't think we make it hard on ourselves. I think there's a lot of obstacles. And as someone who's lived outside the valley, I had the privilege of my mom being very supportive and very, like, you know, she's very good at saving and like using her little savings to help me out. Even if, like, to a lot of people that didn't grow up with the same background I did, that doesn't seem like a lot. To me, it was a lot, you know, to like financial literacy, like that's like a privilege. And like, you know, having citizenship status, like having like a younger mom who's technologically savvy, who can help me fill out my financial aid forms. Like, you know, I think all these little things have helped me, and I'm very privileged because of it. And I don't think we make it hard on ourselves. I just think everyone's stories is very different and backgrounds are very different.
Yeah, and I think something that I kind of like, because the last time, you know, we had a little argument about that whole thing, and you know, thinking about it like a couple days later, and I was like, you know what, maybe that's their perspective, and I guess I gotta respect it. But yeah, I feel like there's more people out there that kind of it's different for everybody. You know, people might have that weight on their shoulders where they have to help support their family and they can't really leave and go to college and make a career out of the valley, or you know, yeah, everybody's story is different. And I guess kudos to my friend, because, you know, despite he wasn't somebody that was privileged, you know, he did you know, come from a similar background like I did, and he was able to make a career and you know, retire from the Marines and you know support his family and whatnot. So I don't know if he's gonna listen. I don't know if he's gonna be mad that I brought it up, but I feel that it's been something that's been on my mind a lot. In the sense that, you know, because I bring up a lot the sense that I grew up in low income homes, in my, you know, that's the environment I grew up. You know, it was like 90 some apartments that were low income. All of my friends were, you know, low income. I'm not sure if none of my friends that I grew up with, you know, went to college or university. A lot of them have decent careers and, you know, have, you know, support their families. But I did feel that, you know, for the majority of the part growing up, you know, we weren't part of Calexico because we were like low income. Oh, it's, you know, the kids that live in those apartments. So, you know, even as, you know, living here, I didn't feel like I was part of this community. I could imagine, you know, going somewhere else where like you don't have the same experiences as somebody, like you said, from Calexico is a little bit more privileged, you know, going away to college was something that was expected, or something that, you know, their parents might have kind of enforced on them. When for our parents, it was like, you know, they would just work and we would see them every so often. So that's where I come in that sense, where, you know, yeah, it's harder for us, because as it is, it's not something that's instilled in our, you know, life. Like, oh, you need to go to college. Just, you know, get out of the house, make it and pay your bills.
No, yeah, I definitely agree. And thank you for sharing your experience. I grew up very similarly, where, like, you know, I grew up with a single mother on welfare, Section 8, you know, like and she's like, I mean, a lot of my inspiration from her. She's like had me when she was 17, you know, and like she's such a hard worker, and she like she's a hustler, and she like, you know, like went to community college, learned English, and, you know, has been doing a lot of great things in the valley, built her own business from like the ground up. And but I did, and then all my family in Mexicali too, they're pretty low income, you know, so I just very similar to you feel like I wasn't expected to go to college. It wasn't something that you know, was expected of me. And actually when I was 15, my mom ended up marrying my stepdad who was in the military, and I feel like that changed like our material conditions. But I mean, they still had to work extremely hard. And I remember at some point my mom being like, why don't you just join the military? Which is kind of funny thinking about me, like, you know, in the military, because I'm like not like I am very shy, or I wasn't very fit at all back then also. So that would have been really like, it wasn't like a good like place for me personally. And but yeah, I wasn't expected to go to college. I like, you know, like I had to figure out a lot of things in my own, a 4-year institution. Like my mom would have been just as proud of me. Would I have done something different, you know, as long as it meant like bettering myself to a certain extent. But I do feel that, especially when I got to college, I felt like, you know, I was going to hanging out and like being peers with kids who went to like very fancy private schools and like all over the country, like at one of the most top competitive universities in the country. And I just felt like I didn't have knowledge of so many things, just like background knowledge, but also even like little things. Like, I don't even know what this vegetable is because I've never seen it in my life. You know, I don't know what it, like, I remember I tried to make a salsa and I was using parsley instead of cilantro. And I'm like, I don't know what, like, this is, why does it taste so weird? And just trying to teach myself a lot of things that I just felt so behind on. But yeah, definitely that experience of always, and even in Calexico within itself, to be honest, sometimes I just feel like I just felt alienated even in junior high and high school from a kid who I felt more privileged, but who I was all in the same classes as, because I was like in the honors classes, you know? So, and I think that was very jarring, because like when I explained to people, like, I'm from Calexico, it's in the border, but it's also, I also experienced classism within Calexico. A lot of people are surprised.
Yeah, it's true. Like, it's like I said, you know, growing up in Las Pichoneras, like, it was something that, you know, you could feel, like, you knew, like, you weren't the same as other kids that you grew up with. Was it something that I wanted to ask you? Oh, no, I wanted to comment something, was that, you know, a while back when I started my YouTube channel with my son, I remember one time we were driving by and we saw this man that would walk around Calexico and he would pick up trash. His name is Jack. I haven't heard from him in a while. I hope he's still alive. But something that he mentioned to me was that is always in my head, is that because he was, I think he was in the service, but he said, you know, something that I always prided myself with was that, you know, even though I could sit with, you know, the smartest people in the world, I know something that they don't. So, you know, that makes me equal to them, because not everybody knows everything, you know. So that's kind of something that kind of like has always been in my mind that ever since he told me, because yeah, like you said, you go out and you know, see all these kids from, you know, really wealthy backgrounds, you know, private schools and all this, but at the end of the day, that there's always going to be something that you know that they don't, or like some subject that you're very proficient in that they're not. So that's something that I'm not really when it comes to talking to people, like, I don't feel like, oh, you know, they know more than me or whatever, because, you know, there's something that I know that they don't. So, I don't know, just a little piece of advice that I got from Jack, good old Jack. So if there's somebody here in the Valley that, you know, kind of like grew up in your shoes, my shoes, a little bit similar, what would you tell them in terms of, you know, kind of like making something or doing, going to school, or like, what advice would you tell somebody young here in Calexico or from the Imperial Valley?
That's a good question. I mean, I guess I'm trying to think of what I want to be told to me, you know. I think one piece of advice is go at your own pace and what you feel comfortable with, and try not to be at the same rate as others. That's something that I keep telling myself, because, you know, I did graduate later than a lot of people, but I'm also feel like waiting make me like get to where I am now, and I'm very happy where I am. So if I would have rushed things, I don't think I would have been in the same position. So like, if you need more time, definitely take more time. I always think the internet's your best friend. And if you have access to the internet, if you're able to have access to the internet, use it as much as possible. Like, do your research and not rely solely on what, like, you know, counselors tell you, or just like what the school tells you. I think it's always good to try to get many perspectives on a different academic path. I think university is not always the answers. There's so many great like programs and so many great careers that you can have without going to a four-year university. And I think it's like staying true to yourself of what you want to do. And I think another advice is like, just always don't be embarrassed to ever reach out to other people who, like, especially from Calexico or from the Valley, who are doing something that you want to be doing. I feel like a lot of us like are very happy talking to like the youth. I strongly believe we really need to empower like the youth, and they're going to make a lot of changes in the future. And I'm really excited for the future generations and how like moved and political they are. So I just think it's like, you know, like, do your research, go at your own pace, but also like, don't be afraid to apply to something just because you think you might get rejected. Just shoot your shot. Always shoot your shot, because you never know. That's what I've always keeps happening. Every time I shoot my shot, I'm like, I'm never going to get this. And it ends up working out somehow. And I just feel like a lot of us are scared because we don't want to be denied, and rejection sucks. But you know what sucks more? Wondering later why you didn't even try.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, like, there's nothing to lose. You're just asking, you know, like, what, you know, you're going to get a no for an answer, and that's pretty much it. You're hurt. You're going to get your feelings hurt for a little bit, and, you know, you'll move on, and it'll make you probably better and stronger. You mentioned the youth. You know, recently here in Calexico, we've had a big, even in the Imperial Valley, we've had this, you know, trend where, you know, a lot of younger generations are coming back and, you know, demanding change on, you know, pretty much everything. You know, change in our leadership, change in equality, and you mentioned it in the Calexico Chronicle article. Have you had a chance to talk to, you know, some of these, you know, like the people that created the Imperial Valley, what is it, Equity? I always forget their name. What is it? Imperial Valley Equity and Justice Coalition. Have you had a chance to talk to them?
Yeah, you know, just like Daniela and Luisito, and Luis Flores. So I'm pretty good friends with Luis, and that's how I learned, like, through him, I learned, like, so much about the coalition, all the incredible work they're doing. So big shout out to them. And so I haven't really talked to a lot of youth, because I haven't spent much time. Like, when I go, I'm usually with my family only. But hopefully after COVID, it's something that I do want to focus on, especially after the ACLU post. Some people reached out to me on Instagram and, like, added me, and I thought that was really cool, because I'm, like, I feel really happy just seeing, like, a bunch of, like, youth from Calexico being so mobilized. And, like, I don't know, I just like this internet era. Like, I love it, you know? So, yeah, I just, like, I've been, like, sporadically talking to people here and there, but that's something that I really want to, like, do more once COVID is over and we can all hang out in person.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, and I've had a chance to talk to, you know, a couple of them. And like I said, like, it's not only here in Calexico, like, all over the Imperial Valley, a lot of, there's a group called Valle Vota. So they're, you know, getting people to go out and vote. They're talking about, you know, propositions, what they're about, but putting, like, little short stories of the candidates. And yeah, like, it's amazing how much they're doing, and at the same time, how much people are kind of afraid of them, like, you know, being involved, which I kind of like, because it kind of, like, makes you realize that, you know, they're afraid of the change, because it kind of means, you know, they're kind of, like, being kicked out of, you know, place, you know, these positions that they've felt they were, you know, like, ownership over, like, kind of like, it reminds me kind of like Lindsey Graham, like now begging for support on, you know, for funds on Fox News. Yeah, and a lot of people, like, you know, I've seen a lot of, you know, really people, you know, really weird, you know, like people tagging other people's signs with homophobic slurs and all these things. And it's like, man, like, it's so crazy that, you know, I didn't see my city as, you know, what they're displaying on these signs. And it's crazy. And I think that a big part of why people are up in arms is because, you know, a lot of younger generations are getting involved and, you know, asking for change. You know, it's time for change. And it's not only here, but all over the country. I feel that I'm sure that you're seeing it over in New York as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think I love this, you know, I love this energy. And like, I think they should be afraid of the youth because, I mean, they're the next leaders. And I do think we as we grow older, we should always be empowering the youth because they always keep us on check, you know, and like we need to get moving with the times, you know, and especially right now, right? Like this time is very special and it has given, in my opinion, like people a lot of confidence to speak up, and like seeing it happening all around the country has created a lot of small bubbles and a lot of like small grassroots organizations that are fighting for change, which I'm very excited to see. And, you know, I just like, I want this momentum to continue no matter who's the president, which is something that like, whoever gets elected, I'm like, we should continue this level of like activism and demand for change.
Yeah, I think that that's really important that, you know, it continues, that it's not only, I guess, like a phase, you know, that, you know, they continue with the passion that, you know, they're doing it at now, because it's important and it's needed, you know, all around, not only in, you know, LGBTQ rights, but, you know, civil rights, like all over the board, you know, it's gone to a point where, like, you know, we're in 2020 and yet we're still dealing with a lot of things that, you know, we dealt in the 60s, and it's, you know, bullshit, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I feel like a lot of things did not change. They were just reform sometimes. So I just feel like sometimes to abolish some institutions that can be reformed and abolish a lot of ideals that cannot be reformed.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we've been at it for almost an hour now. I don't want to keep you any longer because it's already 9 over there where you're at. But any closing thoughts, anything that you would like to add that I didn't, you know, ask you or talk about?
I don't think so, but I just wanted to thank you and thank you so much for doing this. And I'm really excited to keep hearing the episodes of this podcast. I feel like it was very much needed to have like a podcast for Calexico. And thank you so much for all the work you do and for like representing everyone in the community, but also like advocating for people in the community and boosting local business in the community. So I just really appreciate you taking the time and considering me to talk today.
No, thank you for taking the time. Thank you for sharing your story. I think it's really important to kind of put a spotlight on people like you that, you know, especially, you know, I don't know your background, you know your mom living in Section 8 home, you know, housing is something that I didn't, you know, it wasn't on the article. And like I said, you know, kudos to Calexico Chronicle. I keep pointing this way because I have another monitor with my, but kudos to Calexico Chronicle because, you know, they wrote a really good story about you. But like I told you, you know, it's kind of hard to, you know, put a lot of, you know, your story in print because of, you know, space limitations and all that. So podcasting is a good way to kind of like, you know, dive a little bit more into, you know, who you are and stuff like that. And I feel that, you know, knowing your story, knowing, you know, living Section 8, single mom, it kind of like shines a light on a lot of, or kind of like shows a lot of young women here in Calexico that might be in the similar shoes that you were growing up, that, you know, anything is possible. You know, that, you know, taking your time, like you said, is a big part of, you know, kind of like seeing where you are at or where you want to go. And yeah, that, like, and, you know, it doesn't matter if you're from a privileged family here in the Valley in Calexico, you know, you can go anywhere. You can be 2,600 miles away and still represent Calexico proudly, like you are.
Yeah, and I mean, Calexico is my home. I'll be coming back so like often. So I mean, you or whoever wants to grab lunch once, you know, the pandemic is over, we should just do like a huge gathering.
yeah, for sure, that'll be fun. Well, thank you again. Thank you so much for taking this time. I really appreciate it. I was really excited to talk to you. Like I said, I was kind of tired of talking to politicians or people running. Not that I don't like them. You know, a lot of people that I've met, you know, are running for the first time and they're great people, trying to make change in our community as well. But I just want to like get this election over with and just start talking to, you know, people who are doing great things in our community and for our community. And like I said, not that the people who are running aren't doing great things.
No, it's just, I get it. It's tiring. It's fatigue. I just want this election to be over already because I just want to know like what's next we don't even know what's going to happen. So we'll see next week what happens.
Well, I don't even think next week. I don't think we're going to see next week. We'll be in limbo next week, but yeah, it's kind of hard to kind of like picture season two of this show we're living in is going to look like, but yeah, you know, I digress, but yeah. Thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Guys. Thank you guys for listening, watching, and stay safe. Make sure you wear your face mask. It's really important that you guys stay safe, wash your hands, social distance, and we'll see you guys. And then Ellen, you haven't voted yet. Please make sure you vote. It's really important. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.